One, Apple Valley Gardens Association, Inc. versus Gloria Macata. And we have a lot of different people appearing. We have 12 minutes for Attorney John A. Kastner III, representing the amicus curiae, the Wisconsin Realtors. We've got 13 minutes for Randall Nash, representing the Macutas. We have 25 minutes for Matthew Jelenchik, who represents Apple Family Gardens Association, Inc. 5 minutes, Jonathan Levine, counsel for the Amicus Curiae Community Associations Institute, and 5 minutes for Randall Nash in rebuttal. Is that the agreed upon time? You can proceed, Mr. Kastner.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. Members of the court, may it please the court, I'm John Kastner of Wendell Center. Of Murphy Desmond. I appear today on behalf of the Wisconsin Realtors Association on time ceded by the Macutas. I want to thank them for the opportunity to appear today. There's two things I want to accomplish today. First of all, I want to explain to the court that state law expressly provides that where there's a conflict between the declaration and the bylaws, the declaration controls. Second, state law further provides that amendments to a declaration that are adopted subsequent to the purchase of a unit are only binding upon owners that acquire that unit after the amendment. In this case, the declaration in this condominium necessarily implies that rentals are permitted. There are numerous provisions that are cited in the briefs, I'm sure the court's read them, that explain that rentals are permitted and how they'll be handled.
It doesn't say exactly rentals are permitted.
It does not expressly state that rentals are permitted.
What does it say?
I apologize, I don't have the precise language.
Okay. Well, because we have the precise language, I'd like everybody in the room to hear the precise language if we can find it, so we know that this case involves interpretation of precise language in the declaration, in the bylaws, and also in the statutes, right? That's what the case is based on, right?
That's what the case is about. The declaration provided in the purpose and restriction on use provision of the declaration, which is the key provision of the declaration for purposes of this litigation, that the buildings in each of the units are intended for the purpose of single-family residential use only and are restricted to that use. It goes on to state, any lease or oral or written rental agreement shall not relieve an owner from his obligation to pay common expenses or any other obligations imposed upon unit owners by this declaration. Clearly, the declaration contemplated that units could be rented and provided that tenants would be bound by the declaration just as unit owners would be bound by the declaration and the bylaws and the other documents of the condominium. So that was the clear understanding when the condominium was created. The bylaws initially were silent with regards to whether the units could be rented or not. But that isn't the way it stayed. In 2002, the bylaws were amended. And they essentially prohibit rentals after the existing tenants vacated the property. Now, that creates a clear conflict between the language of the declaration and the language of the bylaws as amended in 2002. The Court of Appeals determined that somehow it needed to harmonize the provision between the fact that the declaration could be amended and the bylaws could be amended. But the Court of Appeals did not look at the statute that's supposed to resolve that problem. That statute is 703.30, Rules of Construction. Subsection 4 is specifically intended to resolve the question. It states conflicts in provisions. If there's any conflict between any provision of a declaration and provisions of a condominium plat or any provisions of the bylaws, provisions of the declaration shall control. The Court of Appeals came to the opposite conclusion, but I believe it was the wrong conclusion. There's a reason for that. Declaration is more or less the constitution for the condominium association. It's supposed to be difficult to amend. Bylaws are easier to amend. In this instance, the court should find that rentals are permitted because the declaration says so. If there's a conflict between the declaration and the bylaws, the statute says the declaration controls. There needs to be a basis for deciding the answer to that question. The second aspect of this is that if the association can't solve its problem by amending the bylaws, if the bylaws would conflict with the declaration, then necessarily they're going to move to the declaration, try to amend that. It is our contention that the statute allows the declaration to be amended, but provides that that amendment will only be binding upon subsequent purchasers. Let me explain how I get there. Circuitous route. There's a Florida case. It's cited in the CAI brief, Mr. Levine's brief. And it says that in Woodside Village Condominium Association versus Jarin, it was a case where the declaration was amended to prohibit rentals, as the bylaws were amended in this case. But they amended the declaration. And the Florida Supreme Court, concluded that the Florida statutes compel that outcome. But the court was troubled by the outcome. At page 464 of its decision, that decision, by the way, appears at 806 Southern 2nd, starting at page 402. It's a 202 decision of the Florida Supreme Court. In that decision, the Florida Supreme Court said that it was troubled by the outcome. It didn't say that, but it said the question is, of course, how far can two-thirds of the condominium owners go in restricting leasing rights in the condominium units? People bought these units because, and the declaration said they could rent. And they bought the units in reliance upon what the declaration said. But of course, the statute said they could amend the declaration. The court went on to say that although we believe such concerns are not without merit, in other words, they were troubled by the outcome that they came to. Although we believe such concerns are not without merit, we are constrained to the view that they are better addressed by the legislature. The Florida Supreme Court didn't really like the outcome that it came to, but it felt that it needed to send people to the legislature for relief. Wisconsin statutes don't compel the same outcome. And in particular, I'm referring to Wisconsin Statute 703.10, paragraph 1, which was cited in everybody's brief. But everybody only read the first part of that statute. That statute says, it's bylaws. It's a statute that establishes the requirement that bylaws be created and how they'd be administered. And subsection 1 is entitled Bylaws to Govern Administration. States, the administration of every condominium shall be governed by bylaws. Every unit owner shall comply strictly with the bylaws. This is the important part. As the bylaws or rules are amended from time to time. And the sentence continues. And with the covenants, conditions, and restrictions set forth in the declaration or in the deed to the unit. But it doesn't say as amended from time to time. They could have. They could have included the declaration up above when they referred to the bylaws or the rules as amended from time to time. They could have included the declaration, but they didn't. And from that I conclude that their intent was that if you relied on the declaration when you bought, you could rely on it till you sold.
How do you change the declaration?
It takes a two-thirds or greater vote of the membership entitled to vote at a meeting specifically called for the purpose of an amendment to the declaration.
Did that happen here?
No. In this case, Justice Prosser, all they did was to amend the bylaws, which is significantly easier because when you amend the declaration, you not only need the approval of the unit owners, you need the approval of two-thirds of the mortgage lenders. That's an important point. Mortgage lenders don't want to make loans in condominium projects because if they have to foreclose, they want to know that if they take that unit back in a foreclosure, that they're going to be able to rent it if they can't sell it. And the vast majority of condominium documents that I've reviewed and every one that I've ever written specifically provides that rentals are permitted because you don't do the developer that you're representing any favors if you write documents that the buyers can't buy under. If they need a mortgage to buy and the lender won't lend if they can't rent that unit if they take it back, then they can't buy and the developer doesn't sell. So most projects provide for rentals. It's a necessary evil in order to get lenders to lend money to people to buy in that project. And if you take away the ability of lenders to rely upon that, they'll stop lending or they'll make it harder to lend.
I was looking, and I don't have it in front of me now, the practice manual, the CLE practice manual, State Bar. And in that, it had a provision that it is, as I recall it, common to, and I'm paraphrasing since I don't have it in front of me, common for rent restrictions to appear in bylaws rather than in declarations.
I believe Justice Bradley that he said the opposite, that typically they appear in the declaration rather than the bylaws, but I believe that Mr. Ishikawa conceded that the statute does permit an amendment to the bylaws to address the use of the unit, but it was his opinion that things that affect how you can use the unit really should be in the declaration.
My recollection is that the update of the practice materials said differently, but let me find that and I'll check it out. Now, that was my recollection.
I know he addressed the fact, he was addressing the impact of the Banker's Life case or the Banker's Trust case, but he did not change his position that it would still be better to put restrictions on use in the declaration. Now, you know, the problem is if you've got a buyer and they're looking to buy and they have a particular use that they want to make of the property, let's say they want to be able to rent or they want to have pets or they want to be able to if it's a resort project that's specifically set up as a rental pool arrangement where people will buy a condo with the expectation they're only going to stay there 2 weeks of the year, and somebody's going to manage the property as a rental for the rest of the year, and the rents will help cover the cost of the mortgage. Those people buy that project because the declaration says how it's going to be used, and they want to be able to rely on what the declaration says.
The declaration is recorded.
The declaration is the recorded.
Deeds office.
Yes.
The bylaws are not recorded.
The bylaws are not.
Okay.
My time is up.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. Thank you, Your Honor. May I begin by adding one thing to the response to Justice Prosser's question, and that is the section that deals with amending a declaration, the section of the Condominium Act, is 703.09 sub 2. And one of the components of that is, as mentioned by counsel, that first mortgage holders not only get to vote, but if they don't vote, the owner can't vote. And I submit that that's one of the important aspects of this case, because one of the reasons that we believe that the Court of Appeals decision should be reversed is section 703.09 sub 1 sub G, which says that a condominium declaration shall contain a statement of the purposes for which the building and each of the units are intended and restricted as to use.
Well, what's the provision in the bylaws about operation that says the bylaw can provide for operation?
I believe I know what you're asking. That's 703.10 sub 3.
Okay, I'm there now. The bylaws also may contain any other provision regarding the management and operation of the condo, including any restriction on or requirement respecting the use and maintenance of the units and the common elements. So if you just look at these side by side, it looks like it could be in the declaration, or it could be in the rental could be in the bylaws.
Well, if you're right about that, I lose. Okay.
Well, I understand that. That's why I'm raising that with you, so that you can tell me why you think that rental has to be under 1G and not under 703.10.3 that says bylaws may contain a provision regarding management, operation, use, and maintenance.
I believe, first, that the 703.10 sub 3 management and operation language is a limitation on what can be in the bylaws. Second, I believe that 703.09 sub 1 sub G, which deals with the declaration, indicates to all of us in Wisconsin that the declaration shall, so it starts out mandatory, not may, like the other section. Then it goes on and says, contain a statement of the purposes, and I accent the word purposes, for which the unit are restricted as to use. And I would submit that if you're talking about a single family residence, which is the purpose that was identified in the declaration, which council already mentioned, single family residence is composed of two elements, I would say, that are relevant for today's purposes. One is an owner-occupant. Another is a renter. There's two bundles of rights if you own a condominium. But if you, in the writing of a declaration, or even the amending of a declaration, wish to make that condominium, this form of ownership that we now have in Wisconsin, if you wish to restrict it to owner-occupied, and if you wish to preclude or take away from that bundle of rights the idea that you can rent the unit, you got to put it in the declaration. And I would submit that the reason that that's right, that that's accurate, that that's pursuant to the law of Wisconsin is 703.09 sub 1G, where it says shall contain a statement of the purposes. And I'm saying purpose means owner or renter, for which the unit is restricted as to use.
Counselor, with the circumstances we have here, I can buy your argument if I'm going out and I'm looking for a condominium. Although I used to own one, I don't anymore, but when I did get the bylaws, but they were recorded too. Why they were recorded too, I'm not sure. But I can see what you're saying about having it in the declaration because it's always recorded. And it's to give notice to people of what they're buying so that they know what they can rely on. But here you have people who already owned it, and the bylaws were changed. Now, unless I buy your co-counsel's argument that you can't change that factor unless it's put in the declaration, and you can't change the declaration as long as an original owner owns it, what's the difference whether it's in there or not? In other words, you have it in the bylaws. They knew it was in the bylaws. They could put it in the declaration tomorrow, and that would be taken care of in regard to your statutory argument, unless I buy your co-counsel's argument that it doesn't do you any good to put it there because these owners aren't subject to changes in the declaration. Is that right?
Well, I think I follow your question, and I think there's a couple parts to my response.
Okay.
All right. First of all, I would say that the people I represent, one of them was the declarant of the this condominium association.
Sure.
That may or may not impact things. Second, I would say that the point that I mentioned with in response to Justice Prosser's question, which is 703.09 sub 2, which goes into how you vote if you wish to amend a declaration, is different than how you vote if you wish to amend a bylaw. And I think that matters.
Okay, well, was the vote insufficient here to amend the declaration?
They never sought the votes. Well, I would say that the vote was insufficient if you're trying to say one equals the other, okay? The reason I say that is under 703.09 sub 2, you have to get the written consent of the first mortgage holder. They didn't do that.
Are you saying that it is clear that the members as a whole could have prevented rental units if they had done it in the right way?
Well, I don't know if they could do it in the right way. Maybe we're saying the same thing but differently. I don't know that they would get consent from the first mortgage holders, which is what they would need. Does that respond to your question?
Counsel, wasn't there a mechanism in this instance where potential buyers would get notice of the bylaws?
Yes.
And in fact, wasn't that a requirement?
Yes.
And if they read the bylaws and they saw, geez, there's no renting allowed, then I think they had 10 days to back out of the deal.
I believe that's right.
But
I'm not representing a new buyer. You know what I'm saying? I'm representing somebody who was there, who has been there from day one, who had been renting the unit for more than 20 years, and then they said no more.
Well, and you're also representing someone who was in a lawsuit about this very issue, true?
Yes.
And that lawsuit was settled, I believe. That's true, too.
Yes.
And as part of the settlement, isn't it fair to say that he agreed that he wouldn't rent anymore after the current renters were out?
No.
Okay, what did it say in that point?
Well, that he could still rent his unit.
Okay, but we're talking about his wife's unit.
Yeah.
So my point remains.
Well, but then if the right to rent her unit cannot be taken away because of 703-091-G or 09 sub 2 or 0.10 sub 3, then she still has the right to rent.
Or the settlement of a lawsuit.
Well, but I think part of the issue was she wasn't a party to that lawsuit.
Didn't she sign the settlement agreement? I thought she signed it,
but it was marital property right at that time. She didn't own a unit at that time. And then under some estate planning in the intervening 10-year or 12-year period, she acquired a unit.
She acquired the unit from her husband.
Yes.
And she acquired the unit after the husband agreed that he retained the right to rent his place.
Yes. One possible way to look at this case, it seems to me, especially after the Court of Appeals decision, is are there any checks at all on the power of the association? And I would submit to you that there are statutory checks on the powers of the association, and we've gone through several of them. I would also say that there are common law checks on the powers of the association. And that brings up an issue where maybe I disagree with counsel for the association. And that is, do general legal principles that are applicable to real estate apply to a condominium unit? Their position, I believe, in their briefing here is that they do not. And so if there is a general legal principle in Wisconsin, such as this court has consistently held that public policy favors the free and unrestricted use of property, seems to me that would favor the interpretations that I'm submitting exist to these condominium statutes.
Counsel, I'm going to ask you essentially the same question I asked counsel earlier, and that deals with the treatise, Drafter's Guide to Wisconsin Condominium Documents, put out by the CLE. And your opposing counsel advances that you're relying on an outdated version, the 204 version of that treatise. And the Court of Appeals also cited the 204 version of that treatise, which suggested that there were concerns at times, in talking about the banker's case, trust case, that there were concerns. The declaration is the most difficult to amend, and that it appears that this restriction often is in the declaration. But in 207, their point is that treatise was changed, and it reads, use restrictions often appear in the declaration, but they can just as easily be placed in the association's bylaws or rules and regulations, citing the Ishikawa and Mullins guide. Can you respond to that?
Well, with all due respect to them, I think they're being a little bit ambiguous with the use of the word use. the types of uses that can be in either the declaration or the bylaws. That is to say, I would submit that under 703.09 sub 1G, there are some uses that have to be in the declaration. The legislature used the word shall, and I'm asserting it's mandatory.
And what uses does 703.09.1G say has to be in the declaration, as opposed to the uses that can be set forth in the bylaws?
All I could do is parrot the language of 1G, and that is to say uses which represent a statement of the purposes for which the unit is intended or restricted as to use.
So statements of the purposes for which the building and each of the units are intended, okay, that's one thing, and restricted as to use. So my question remains, how does 703.09 inform what restrictions can be placed, what restrictions as to use have to be placed in the declaration as opposed to being placed in the bylaws? Where do you get this language as to what restrictions have to be there?
My time is up. May I respond?
Yes, you shall.
I guess what I would try to say is what I said before, and that is that if we are talking about a purpose for which the building or unit is intended or restricted, then we have to put it in the declaration. And the bylaw is a broader document where you may include provisions regarding the management and operation of the condominium. So I think when you go back to the Ishikawa treatise, I believe that they're talking about different types of uses. So,
Chief, if I may.
Go ahead.
But you were talking about, you just said 703.10 sub 3, permissible uses in the bylaws, and you talked about management and the operation, but you forgot the words use there. Management and operation of the condominiums, including any restrictions on or requirements respecting the use.
Am I missing something? Tell me what I'm missing then, since use is in there, not just management.
Well, I'm not saying they can never put it in the bylaw. I'm saying they have to put it in the declaration if the use or the purpose that you're talking about is to restrict someone's ability to rent the unit. Now, if you do that, I'm saying, number one, you shall put it in the declaration. They didn't do that here. Second, you may put it in the bylaws, and then maybe you put in some things that go with that. So, for example, in this case, they were asking that you give a copy of the lease to the condominium association.
Councilor, I didn't get all the answers to my question that I asked you earlier on, mm-hmm. and one of them was whether they could amend the declarations at this point in time. And I would like you to answer that for me. What is there some reason why this declaration can't be amended?
May I respond, Your
Honor? Yes, you may.
They can do it.
Okay.
But they have to do it a certain way.
They may, and I went back and looked at something in the statute while you were answering one of my colleague's questions. But, you know, to me the purpose of the declaration is to give public notice, easy notice to people so they know what they're getting. And they can look at that and they can have some understanding of it. But these are people that had notice. They knew what was going on. They participated. They didn't get the results they wanted, but they knew what was going on. Now, if they can amend the declaration now, do you agree or disagree with your colleague that that amendment would have no effect on your client?
Well, I would say, I may respond again. I would say that
as long as they keep asking questions,
I didn't know if I had to ask each time. I'm sorry. now I've lost my train of thought.
No. Yeah, no, I was asking you if, in fact, you agree with me that it can be amended.
Yes.
They could amend it today to have a use restriction so it would be owner-occupied. Do you agree with your colleague that it wouldn't affect these particular owners?
That's correct.
Okay, so yes. You can't change the declaration ever, according to your theory. Once somebody owns the condominium, that's it. Whatever it says when you buy it, it's that way for as long as you have it.
Well, I would say this. If you do go through the process of amending the declaration,
right.
You do have to bring in the first mortgage holders.
All of that I'm not arguing with you about.
And that their vote trumps the owner's vote.
I'm not arguing with you about any of that. I thought we had agreed that, yes, you can still amend this declaration, but my question really goes to your colleague's major premise, which is it doesn't matter if you do. It's not going to affect these folks anyway. And that's the question I want the answer to.
Well, and under the point he was making, I believe what you're saying is correct, that these people were there earlier, and so therefore, if they were a new buyer, then his point kicks in.
His point was because they already owned it, you could not change the declaration for as long as they owned the condominium. And I'm asking you, do you agree with that premise?
Well, I believe his point is under 703.10 sub 1, it does not say as amended.
I understand his argument, but the point of it is the point I'm trying to get you to either disagree or agree with me on. I understand his argument well. He put it forth clearly, I think. And I'm asking you, do you agree that you can never change the declaration for these folks? They always get the declaration they had when they first developed this and bought some units in it.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nash. Jelinchik, representing Apple Valley Gardens Association.
Good afternoon, Justices. May it please the Court. My name is Matt Jelinchik. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff respondent, Apple Valley Gardens Association, Inc. Also here today is the president of the association, Marianne Holt. We're very pleased to be here today to discuss these important issues. Condominium ownership is a creature of statute. It does not exist otherwise. It is the Wisconsin Condominium Ownership Act that created this new form of ownership. All of the questions presented in this appeal are answered by the act itself. Can use restrictions be contained in the bylaws? Yes. That's 703.103. Are owners bound by amendments to bylaws, retroactive or otherwise? Are they bound by amendments? Yes, 703.101. Do bylaws render title unmarketable? No, 703.106. And do bylaws suspend the right of alienation? No, they cannot, 703.301. The Condominium Act has addressed every question provided here. The McCuttas and the Wisconsin Realtors Association do not like the answers the legislature have made to these questions. So they're asking the court here to change the answers. And in doing so, they're asking the court to change the act, to rewrite the Condo Act.
Could I ask, your first point was whether that bylaws could impose use restrictions. Is that right?
Yes, Justice Prosser.
All right. There could certainly be use restrictions that were not in the declaration. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. And in fact, this declaration provides that rules and restrictions as to use may be contained in the bylaws. The declaration specifically contemplates that.
So if new use restrictions were adopted in the bylaws, that wouldn't be so troublesome. It certainly would be a different case from the situation in which the use restrictions were in direct conflict with the declaration.
There is a conflict provision in the Condominium Act, and if there was a conflict, the conflict provision, which is 703.30, I think, sub 3 or 4, it's rules of construction, says the declaration controls over the bylaws. The declaration itself says in the event of conflict, the declaration controls. But in that statute that addresses the construction of the condominium documents, it also said that they're meant to be read in harmony and not with an eye to create conflict. And the entire purpose of that is not to create upheaval and have all the unit owners understand under what conditions there can be amendments, under what use restrictions and where they can be located. The Condo Act is not designed to create a battle between the declaration and bylaws. It's meant to create harmony. Now, on the point of whether there's a conflict in this case, there's absolutely no conflict. The declaration specifically states that the use is restricted to single-family residential. That's all it says. It then says that if there's a lease or a tenant, the owner is still bound to pay the condo fees and those type of things. That's hardly creating a conflict with a provision in the bylaws that does not permit rentals, partly because there was a grandfather clause. Rentals still continue to this day at this condo association. There were units that were grandfathered in. So there are still leases for units at this condo association, and there are still tenants in place. So that provision in the declaration is just as useful today as it was the day the declaration was formed. And I would note the bylaw at all times had a use provision. That use provision was amended to require owner occupancy, but at the very beginning of this condo association, one of the uses in the bylaws was that it would be senior housing only. Naturally, with open housing laws, that no longer is part of the bylaw. But before there was a restriction on rentals, there was a requirement that the lease be on file with the association and other types of things. Even the McCuttas admit in their brief that rentals were permitted under the bylaws with some minor restrictions.
Counselor, I want to go back and look at the declaration and pester you a little bit, as I did your opposing counsel, about whether you agree that you could amend this declaration under the statutory provisions to indicate that the units had to be owner-occupied. Do you agree with that?
Under the statute permitting declaration amendment, yes. Under the declaration at issue in this case, it would be much more problematic, given Mr. McCutta in the declaration, mind you, he was the declarant and developer and drafted it, retained a veto power for any amendment to the declaration from then to the end of time. Now, there's another statute in the declaration requiring declarant control that would indicate that after 10 years, any provision in a declaration providing the declarant control over the association or any of the condo instruments would be unenforceable. But it's still an issue that the condominium association would have to address, certainly particularly given the history between the association and the developer in this case, had they gone that route. It's also much more problematic and difficult, admittedly, to secure the mortgage lender's approval. And that's another reason why use restrictions, even rental use restrictions, are so useful to be in the bylaws. It's a much more flexible vehicle. There is going to be a changing ownership constituency in condominiums. And let's not forget, the declarant, the developer, drafts the original amendment. He has the vested interest in keeping as much as he possibly can in the status quo. As owners come on board, and they haven't drafted the declaration, they should have a right to control their own condominium development.
Well, how do you explain the declaration that talks about rental? I mean, the implication is you can rent.
And Justice, renting is permitted today as a grandfather for those specific tenants. So if Your Honor is looking whether there's a conflict, I don't think there is one. Whether the declaration permits rental, by implication, it certainly doesn't restrict it. But the fact that the declaration, this particular declaration, delegated rules and regulations regarding use to the bylaws, and the fact that...
Where in the declaration did it do that?
Declaration, which is record item 18, attached as an exhibit to Marianne Holt, the President's Association, is section 21.
Right.
The declaration. The association may make reasonable rules and regulations governing the use of the units and of the limited common area and or common.
That sounds like the statute.
It does. Many times the declaration will mirror the rights that are provided in the Condominium Act.
Right, so we're back to interpreting the statute.
I think there are two authorities, one in the statute and one in the declaration. I think interpreting the statute in favor of allowing use restrictions in the bylaws certainly is less problematic given what the declaration says. On the issue of what bylaws are for, there's been an argument offered that this is corporate governance, internal governance. That is part of what bylaws are for. It's in section 703.10(2). It says how people are going to vote, how assessments can be made, how many people will be on the board, all those type of things are in sub 2. Sub 3, then, is entitled additional provisions, additional permissible provisions. So and that is a provision that states that in the bylaws can also be contained use restrictions on units. And so I think the fact that it's in a separate subsection and is called additional permissible provisions implies that the legislature absolutely saw an internal governance function in sub 2, but then decided in addition to that, and not limited solely to internal governance, use restrictions could also be included. So it's not fair in Wisconsin, particularly given the statutory scheme, to say that bylaws only deal with internal governance. And there's a specific amendment procedure and voting requirements to amend the bylaw. There are statutory safeguards there. And amazingly, everyone with a stake in the condominium gets to vote. This is truly a sub-society democracy. These are not elected officials making decisions for the masses. These are the actual individuals who have a stake vote on the amendment, and the amendment requires a supermajority, over 67%. And that is a set statutory protection on amendment of bylaws. And so given there's a procedure, the legislature certainly contemplated that bylaws would be amended, set forth a procedure, and in 703.101, it states that the owners must obey the bylaws as amended from time to time. So I think this question on retroactivity, first of all, it wasn't argued in the petition and not in the briefs or to the trial court, other than through the amicus participant, but I think that answers the question on retroactivity right there. This is not the same bundle of sticks that people have in common law. This is a statutory form of ownership. As the Court of Appeals said, the statute says what it says, and the McCuttas and we are bound by it. And that's really the case here. Yes, an owner of a condominium gives up some rights. The idea of free and unencumbered use simply is not compatible with condominium ownership in the Condominium Act. But the condominium owner also gains significant rights. That is, the right to have input on the condo development around them and on the activities of their neighbors. So it's not a net loss. It's just a different of rights, property rights. It's just a different type of ownership.
If you were going to write this opinion, and I'm assuming you write it in favor of your client, how would you write it? Just give the outline of the legal arguments you'd make that you think that would be persuasive as an opinion.
Your Honor, I think the decision really could start and end with the Condominium Act itself. My introductory remarks being, can use restrictions be contained in the bylaw? Yes, cite the statute. Are owners bound by amendments in the bylaws? Yes, cite the statute. Is there any unmarketability issues with bylaws, even if amended? No, cite the statute. And do the bylaws affect anyone's right to alienation? No, and cite the statute. That's really the way I'd write this decision.
It sounds so logical, but I have a problem because of the other statute that says the declaration shall, and then G says, have restrictions on use.
It shall.
They conflict, and I can't get over that sense very easily.
Okay. Chief Justice, I think the way to address that is the declaration is a legal document that must be recorded and creates the condominium.
Right.
It is a laundry list of the items that the legislature found was important to be contained in the legal document that creates the condominium.
Mm-hmm.
It is nothing more than a check the box. And one of the boxes that need to be checked is a statement as to the purposes.
Okay, and the statement is residential, single-family residential.
It has
residential.
A statement, okay. Single-family residential
and restricted
to that. That's the
first part. The other part is use.
Use
mean lease, or does it mean has to be owner-occupied?
Mr.
Nash says that when you talk about single-family, it could be either owner-occupied or renting to another family.
I would offer, Your Honor, that the statement of the purposes as to the use and restrictions on use is really all it needs to be is a statement. And so I think it's the most general description. Is it an office condominium? Is it a storage condominium? Is it an airport hangar condominium? Is it going to be a parking condominium? No, it's a single-family residential condominium. It is the most basic of basic statements on what type of condominium is being created.
Yeah, but then didn't the declaration talk about rental?
The declaration in this particular instance had nothing regarding rental other than the clarification that owners are not somehow excused from their obligations by virtue of renting.
The implication is you can rent. Why put it in if you can't rent?
Yes, the implication certainly was that there were no restrictions on renting. The bylaws are drafted with the declaration, are not recorded, and the bylaws also permitted renting. So the declaration may be nothing more than a reflection of what the bylaws happen to state at the time that the bylaws are drafted and enacted. So, again, I think they need to be read together. And what's interesting is this particular declaration delegated in Section 21 regulations and rules regarding the use of units to the bylaws. So I think it recognizes the fact that at the time the declarant establish a condominium, rentals would be permitted. And quite honestly, for developers, that's not uncommon because they're afraid of having, floors and floors of condominiums that they can't sell and need to take some income on. As long as they own those units, they vote their control. The association only takes control through the unit owners after a certain amount of units are seated. And then at that time, the association has a right to present through the ownership use restrictions that are going to be compatible with the present constituency of owners. And that's exactly what happened here. I think undue weight is given to the declaration, particularly when a declaration is drafted in 1970 and now we're in the year 2008.
Counsel, let me ask you this. What effect, if any, do you see with the earlier suit and the settlement of that suit in regard to this present dispute?
Yes, Justice Crooks. The settlement agreement was a defense offered by the McCuttas in the trial court matter. The settlement agreement said that Mr. McCutta would have to sell or use his best efforts to sell the units, and he was allowed to retain, I think, four, either through himself or his family members, and then at some point under further negotiations, he came down to two. Now, what the settlement agreement said was nothing in this settlement agreement shall be construed to restrict or limit Stephen McCutta's right to rent the units. Okay? Now, that settlement agreement, It's the knee-jerk reaction is to think, oh, that's an affirmative right to rent units. But a careful reading of the settlement agreement simply says everything that we're agreeing here, nothing should be construed to restrict Stephen McCutta's right to own one unit and have all rights of use, including the right to rent. The reason that language was in there was because at that time the bylaw permitted rentals. There was nothing in that settlement agreement, and in fact, the settlement agreement said Mr. McCutta would have to obey the bylaws as amended in the future. And so that was an argument that was presented to the trial court. The trial court, since it was Gloria's unit that was at least the issue before the court and pressing issue, kind of sidestepped the settlement agreement on that topic. But I would offer to the court that there are no rights in that settlement agreement for Mr. McCutta to rent units either. It only says that it was not construed to restrict any rights. Those rights didn't come from the settlement agreement. At that time, they came from the bylaws. At least that part of the settlement agreement, I don't think has gotten much treatment through the briefs here.
Does it affect Gloria's rights at all?
Gloria did sign it. She was a party to it. At that time, she did not own any units. What it does is that defense regarding the settlement agreement would not be available to her. It would only be available to Stephen. So truly for her, the condominium documents were what I think the trial court found was most purely at play.
Counsel, is there any reason in your estimation why this case doesn't come down to whether, in fact, there is a conflict between the material terms of the declaration and the material portion of the bylaw?
One reason I don't think it comes down to whether there's a conflict is because it was not the conflict issue, at least to the trial court, was not an argument made by the McCuttas. In the summary judgment brief that I offered in response, we offered the trial court arguments that there is no conflict between these provisions, mainly because of the grandfather clause and the arguments I offered. The response by the McCuttas to that argument was that, and I'll quote this, this is record item 24, the association misunderstands and misstates the McCuttas argument, stating erroneously that the McCuttas argument is based on conflict between the bylaws and the declaration. Instead, the McCuttas argument is that Wisconsin law requires use restrictions to be in the condominium declaration. So at the very least, the way the summary judgment briefs were presented and arguments made, the conflict was not at play.
But you agree that if there is a conflict, it's the declaration that prevails.
The declaration would prevail. Now,
and their argument seems to be, hey, the declaration calls for or allows for leases and rental agreements.
The declaration absolutely controls in the event of a conflict, and the declaration at least contemplates that rentals would be permitted. It certainly does. I think in determining whether there is a conflict between the amended bylaw and the declaration, also attention should be given to the fact that the declaration delegates use restrictions to the bylaws, and the fact that a grandfather clause exists.
Wouldn't your argument also be based upon a certain ambiguity of the phrase, any lease or oral or written rental agreement shall? That appears to be a fairly small portion, a fairly small percentage of the actual sentence that it introduces.
Absolutely. It really doesn't belong in that particular provision. I think it was a clarification. And on top of that, absolutely, and that issue is particularly cogent when you look to the Wisconsin Condominium Act and the rules of construction that say look to harmonize these condominium documents. Don't look with an eye of conflict. I think part of the reason is because the owners are voting, generally volunteer boards of people who do not do these type of things for a living are drafting these amendments, and the whole idea is it's a sub-democracy. It's if the unit owners feel that a use should be placed, it's a right that they've gotten through the Condo Act, and probably part of the reason that they purchase a condominium to control that development around them. They each get to vote. It requires a supermajority, and for those reasons, it's very difficult for the minority to claim vested rights, or that it shouldn't be retroactive, or that they don't have their say, because everyone has their say, and they subject themselves voluntarily and with notice and full disclosure that they don't have free and unencumbered use. They're taking a condominium subject to statutorily set declarations, bylaws, voting procedures, and amendments. On the issue of retroactivity, this was another argument that was not presented in the petitions or in the briefing, but I think it's really important to point out that the bundle of sticks that we're dealing with in condominium law in no way do not translate well at all from common law rights of ownership. When people purchase a condominium, there are notice procedures, even in the Act, for disclosures that it's part of a condominium, there are bylaws and declaration that control, and that they can be amended from time to time. And that whole notice and disclosure, as well as the fact that there are set statutory procedures for these rules to change, really vitiates any argument of any kind of vested right or against retroactivity.
Counsel, why do we talk about marketability in this case? I mean, there's a lot devoted to that, and yet no one's selling. It usually comes up.
Yeah, I think it's a tough sell to start with. But with the marketability issue, what we're really looking at is the title to the property. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about what what seller or group of sellers would be interested in the property, or even what.
And I
really think that the Bankers Trust case had to deal with such disparate facts in trying to block a confirmation of a share of sale that it's really not instructive in this case. Even in that case, all the parties agreed, and the court said was uncontroverted, that the bylaw or that the owner occupancy requirement was enforceable. The question was, could you use it to block a sale at a foreclosure proceeding? The answer was no. And I think it's particularly instructive in 703-106 that the statute says that a bylaw cannot affect title or render title unmarketable. That empowers bylaws. What it really does is prevent a condo purchaser from claiming some kind of defect in title because a bylaw is restricting something that they're not comfortable with. That's why that entire notice and disclosure requirement exists. And on the same issue, in a slightly different thread, is this right of alienation, your ability to convey absolute fee. The long line of cases, starting with Lefevre here in Wisconsin, states a restriction on use, and everyone agrees here that this is a restriction on use, rental restriction, that the right of alienation is not interfered with just because you're restricting a use of the property. You're not prohibiting them from selling the property. And on top of that, there's a statute in the Rules of Construction statute, that's 703.30, that states that the law against the law of perpetuities and the rule against the right of alienation do not apply to condominiums. Another reason why the common law bundle of six just is not translatable. With that, my time is done. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
I have Mr. Levine appearing for 5 minutes. He's counsel for Amicus Curiae Community Associations Institute. Mr. Levine.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Jonathan B. Levine, and I represent the Community Association of Wisconsin. I am not here to argue today whether there's a conflict in this case between the declaration and the bylaws. You can interpret those documents as well as I can. That's your particular expertise. I am here to say that if you say that restrictions cannot be in the bylaws, you will upset many dozens of condominiums. You will create a lot of business for me, but it will be nonsense business, because I respectfully suggest to you that the legislature has invited use restrictions in the bylaws. You already know that you have what appears to be the dual invitations in 703.09 and 703.10, and that's why every time I get a package of documents, I have to look at both, because I don't know where the restrictions are going to be found. That's the way it is. It's not for you to change it, I respectfully submit. But particularly addressing Justice Rogensack on notice, I would go a step further and say that the legislature has specifically invited restrictions recently in the bylaws. There is now a document called the Executive Summary, which must go out along with the offer to purchase at the very beginning, before the buyer even has a right, the right of rescission, very early in the process. And here is one of the things that the Executive Summary must say per our legislature, and I quote, "An indication that a unit purchaser's rights and responsibilities may be altered by an amendment of the declaration or bylaws, and a description of the amendment process and requirements." The legislature at 703.33 sub 1 sub H 11Q, which gives the laundry list of what you must advise a buyer, specifically says, tell the buyer that your rights may be amended by the bylaws. Now, assume for the, and I will tell you, I represent condos for a living. Please accept that both writers for declarants and amenders of declarations have for 30 years been putting restrictions in the bylaws. And we don't think we have been doing it wrong, but we'll wait and abide the outcome. I'd like you to assume that I live in a 20-year-old condominium, and we've now decided that secondhand smoke hurts people, and we don't want secondhand smoke in the lobby and the elevators. Is somebody going to tell me that this community cannot now outlaw smoking in the lobby and the elevators? Do I have a vested right to pollute all my neighbors? Condominiums are by nature.
Where are you going to put this, in the declaration or in the bylaws?
That I would suggest go in the bylaws under the 70310 provision.
That's the question in this case. Not that you can't do it, it's whether you did it right under the statute.
Yes, Your Honor, and I submit that under the bylaw provision, it's a fair invitation. It says use and restrictions of the common elements and the units. Mm-hmm. And not only does it say and the units, but then it says in the executive summary, you must tell people that their rights may be changed by the bylaws. So I think the legislature has been very clear. And to further with Justice Rogan said, there is no time that a buyer gets the declaration that he or she does not also get the bylaws under Chapter 703. And both of them trigger the right of rescission. So while recording is important to change this piece of land into multiple units, as for notice to the buyer, the bylaws and the declaration are similar. Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, for many years, the mortgage syndicators have said you can only have a certain ratio of renters to owner-occupants. So many associations have changed their rental restrictions just so they can make sure that buyers get purchase money mortgages. Another reason for amendments to the bylaws. A community on Lake Geneva may decide that the guy next door is renting his unit every week to get people who like to sail on the lake. And this is interfering with the residential nature of the condominium. Do they have the right? I see my time is up, Your Honor.
You may finish the sentence.
Do they have the right to protect their community through the amendment process? I would conclude by stating that some communities are even fearful that landlords are moving in on them and buying multiple units, and they're losing their middle-class way of living because somebody buys six units and they think, well, the association is going to take care of all my rentals, and I can pretend I'm a landlord. And some associations are passing rental restrictions specifically to provide owner occupancy, which they think will maintain the nature of their property. And finally, please do not buy the vested rights argument of Amicus. He has not cited one single case that says the condo is a state actor, and the condo is not a state actor. It's a private organization. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Levine. Mr. Nash?
Just a couple of points. On the executive summary, 703.33 sub 2A2 says you can't rely on the executive summary. Here's what it says. These disclosure materials given to you as required by law may, with the exception of the executive summary, be relied upon as correct and binding.
Second.
Counsel for the association noted that the association is a sub-democracy. And I think the reason to say that is it's along the lines of, gee whiz, we all voted. It ought to be good enough. And I would submit that there's a structure for this democracy that puts some restraints on the powers of the association. There are checks on their power. And those checks include 703.09 sub 1G as to what has to be in the declaration. Those checks include 703.10 sub 3, which limits what can be in the bylaws. The checks include the fact that in this particular sub-democracy, some other people have rights, and they have the right to be heard.
Counselor, but isn't all this argument totally academic if your client can just veto whatever they put, so they can't really ever comply with the statutes?
Well, I don't know that they're going to concede the point that he can just veto it.
Well, that's what I'm asking you. Is that your position as well, that he can just veto it?
Well, I anticipate he's going to argue, as I think he mentioned here, that there's a limitation as to the duration of any veto power he may have had.
Okay, so you're not really saying that you think he has a veto power at this point. You just don't want to get into that, which I can understand.
I'm saying that he won't agree to it. The association wouldn't agree to it.
I don't care if he agrees. I just want to know what you think.
Well, I think he has whatever power he received in the declaration.
You think he has a veto power and he can just say you can't amend these?
He can't amend the declaration.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
And then a final point I was going to make is that there's another piece of the structure in this democracy, and that is third parties who have rights, and that is with respect to a vote on a declaration, people who finance the condominium or still have mortgages, they have a vote, and that vote is even more important than the unit owners. And that's under 703.09 sub 2. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Nash. Thank you, Mr. Nash. Thank you, Mr. Levine, Mr. Jelinek, and Mr. Castle for your arguments today relating to condos. We haven't had too many condominium cases, but we have many condominiums in Wisconsin. So thank you for coming to Oshkosh to argue this case. And that closes the hearing on 07AP191, Apple Valley Gardens Associations, Inc. versus Gloria McCutta. For those who are here and wish to follow this case, the opinion of the